people are always late and always complain. Those people always think others are to blame. Your people think they should be the first in line. Those people always do the time. People.
There. We're going to start off as we always do and welcome everybody out there for checking out this episode of Those People, a podcast about people with people. As usual, I'm your host, Mitch Gaines. You can find me at Mitch Gaines just about anywhere on the internet that I want to be found. If this is your first time checking out the show, thank you, thank you, thank you. We are so happy to have you here. Those People is a show with people about people where we explore all the labels that others give us and we give ourselves. Every episode, we sit down with a different guest and we interview them about their stories, their successes, their struggles, all the important aspects. Words really, but most importantly, we kick it with them about the people who are involved. So if you love it, we'd love you to go out and go tell a friend. If you hate it, we hate you, and please kindly shut the fuck up forever. I'm just kidding about that last part, but if you do hate the show for real, please shoot me a note at mitchgaines@gmail.com. Tell me what you hated, maybe we'll do a little bit better next time. As always, I also want to take a quick second to remind all of you who do love the show or just some of the people we've had on the show, please subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen. It really helps other people discover this show. Platforms we are now on include Spotify, Stitcher, Anchor, Pocket Cast, my personal favorite, Radio Public, and a whole bunch more. If you happen to be a Google or an Apple listener and you like the show, it'd mean a lot to us if you could rate and review the podcast, but only if you like the show. Save your hate takes for Twitter, where again, you can find me at Mitch Gaines. It's Gaines with a Y because I'm a little bit gay, G-A-Y-N-S. I'm joined today on Those People by Russ Cerencioni, an attorney, a public servant. He's an activist. He's a dad. Previously, Russ worked for a New York State agency where he litigated the rent stabilization laws in court, fought for his tenant rights, and most recently, he's become a candidate for Congress in New Jersey's 6th District, which is home base for both his activism and political work, as well as his family. He's a self-described loud, passionate good guy, and hopefully by the end of this episode, you and everybody out there in NJ6 will know whether or not that's true. Welcome to the show, Russ.
Hey, Mitch, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here. And yeah, so we're fighting for justice in New Jersey's 6th District against an incumbent Democrat, and our primary is June 2020.
June 2020. Awesome. Well, we got some time between then and now, so I want to give some people a chance to get to know you. I start off every episode here with the same two questions. The first, and pardon me if you'll humor me here a little bit, but consent is important. I like everybody to feel comfortable, so I ask everybody the same thing, which is that I need a conversational safe word. So the way that works is very similar to a sexual safe word. Anytime during this conversation, anything gets super uncomfortable, anything's happening that you don't like, you don't feel super okay with, you say that safe word, I will shut the fuck up, and we will change direction and go in a new place in the conversation. Also, like a sexual safe word, if you have to use it like 100 times during this conversation, we should probably end and just not talk to each other for a little while and figure out what went wrong at a later date. So with that said, what is your conversational safe word?
Peanut butter.
Everybody goes with a food-related one. I don't know why that is. All right, I'll take peanut butter. Also, for some reason, it is very common to go with pea-related words. I don't know why. Peanut butter, someone else, I think, used piranha. There was two who used pineapple. It's a very common thing. The first real question I will ask you is where I like to start kind of every interview with is where are you from originally? Are you from Jersey? Are you from somewhere else and transplanted? Like, where are you from?
So I was born and raised in Staten Island, New York.
Okay.
And it's the suburbs of New York City. And it's actually just a bridge over from the current district that I live in. I live in Old Bridge now, New Jersey. Mm. And both my wife and I were born and raised in Staten Island, really close to the district.
I have my own preconceived notions of what childhood in Staten Island is like, being from the East Coast and being from Boston. But what is, for everybody listening out at home, kind of what is, I guess, youth like on Staten Island? What is young Russ?
Well, it was a lot of fun. You know, the community was really tightly knit, I'd say. There were a bunch of kids in the neighborhood, and we spent our days playing basketball in the public parks. We played baseball, and, you know, we even did some crazy things like taking a boat out on lakes and fishing. And it was really a outdoorsy style childhood for me because, you know, my parents' house is located across from a section of the parks that are designated as Green Forever, known as the Green Belt. And so we spent a lot of our time, like, doing outdoorsy stuff in the woods. We built tree houses. We, you know, we had a lot of fun, and it was an outdoorsy childhood for me. Growing up in Staten Island, I guess, is really similar to most suburbs. You have your tight friends that live in the neighborhood, and you know, at that time, cell phones had just like become popular, but you still found your friends by calling the house landline or knocking on their doors, and it was really a lot of fun.
So you're part of that last generation that like you had a childhood both with and without the internet. Like 0 through 10 or 12 or so was like pre-internet, and then by the time you were in college, like everybody had a cell phone and mobile Wi-Fi.
Well, yeah. So I'm 32 years old, okay. And you're right. Growing up, we didn't have much of the internet or cell phones. So so I think, you know, the first messaging platform, AIM, or AOL Instant Messenger, was pretty popular when we were in high school. And it was like the beginning stages of like MySpace when we were in high school. And I think Facebook released the year before that I started college. So yeah, it was the beginning of the internet and Wi-Fi and cell phones when I was in college, really. You know, we had the old school Nextel beepers.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, the walkie-talkies, those were popular in high school. And so the internet really didn't form our childhoods, but we did kind of grow up with the advent of all these new communication technologies.
I'm also that same generation, so I'm a couple years behind you. I'm 29, but I often remark to people that I think that is the generation best suited to lead, because we both have an understanding of what it's like to connect to, you know, individual people in real life, and had to do that at some point. But also, like, you know, you were in college when Facebook got invented. That was still a college only platform. There was like some pride in being on Facebook. It wasn't like a badge of sin like it is now. Things have changed quite a bit over the time. I think the people who've kind of lived through that era and come of age in that era are uniquely suited to lead. I guess you also mentioned, obviously, you know, kind of had a lot of friends and a lot of, you know, kind of a large crowd of you kind of running around the neighborhood. What is kind of your family life like at a young age? I don't know many Italians with small families, let alone ones who live in Staten Island with small families. So I'd imagine there's a whole gang here.
Yeah, we had a big family. We were really close, and you know, the thing that always brought us together was the good food. And I was actually really lucky. My mom was able to be a stay-at-home mom for most of my life, like until I was 16 or 17 years old, before she re-entered the workforce. You know, at that time, my dad's job provided enough for my mom to stay at home and raise her two sons, and it was great because a mother is the person who knows how to raise their kids the best, right?
Intensity.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're seeing less and less of that possibility for the current generations. Like, my wife has to work full time as well. Mm. You know, she's a teacher for the Board of Ed, but I wish that I was able to provide enough for her to stay home full time with our son. But the reality that most Americans face today is both parents have to work. And so to me, I think we have to really return to that high standard of living where one job was enough for an entire family. You know?
Well, I think that's part of the problem these days is sometimes even one job per person isn't enough, right? Like, you have families where both parents are working 2-3 jobs, and it's like, we're barely paying rent. And on top of that, you're shelling out $700, $1,400, whatever it is, in daycare costs and sending your kids to preschool and whatever the case may be. And it's like, how do you get ahead in that economy?
It's very difficult. It's very difficult. I had to work two jobs for the past 3 years, essentially. I have... You know, I've been working full time with my New York State position as an attorney for stabilization laws, like you mentioned. But, you know, I also had to part time supplement my income with being a real estate broker and agent. I understand the struggle of having to work two jobs in today's society. And
Well, and not for nothing, I don't feel like lawyer is one of those jobs that, like, when you hear somebody be like, oh, so, like, how are you making out? It's like, oh, I went and got a law degree. You don't think that guy has a second job. You know what I mean? Like, that shouldn't really be necessary. I feel like if I, you know, trudge my way through 3-4 years of law school on top of my undergrad and then, like, bust my ass studying till 4 o'clock in the morning every night for most of my 20s, like, I should be able to work, I don't know, 65 hours a week and be able to survive.
Yeah, you're right. And that's actually one of the misconceptions of a lot of people think that, oh, you're an attorney, you must have to be making the big bucks. But, you know, I'm a public service attorney. I work for the New York State government. So we do make a good amount, but it's still not even enough to raise a family on its own. You have to supplement and have a side hustle. I saw a recent statistic, like 50% of millennials need to have a side hustle to make ends meet.
As somebody who pretty much has a collection of side hustles that pays his bills currently, I can certainly attest to that. I promise you, whatever you think listening at home, podcasting does not pay as well as you think it does. And please go visit my website and buy some merch. I want to loop back there a little bit because you mentioned you know, it was your mom and you and your brother kind of growing up. I would imagine your brother and you are super close. What's kind of like his influence like on you both as a child? And then kind of are you guys still close today? You know, what's you guys' relationship like?
Oh, yeah. My younger brother, he's my best friend. And he actually moved out to Jersey, too. He moved to Lincroft, New Jersey. And we're still close. And having a younger brother, you always have somebody that you have to look out for. Mm. You know, you have to make sure that I had to make sure growing up that I was setting a good example for him. You know, I was a source of, you know, I was his counsel growing up. Like, he has questions about school. How do you study? How do you make friends? And it's my, you know, as an older brother, older sibling, it's a lot of responsibility on your shoulders.
So I am the baby sibling, and I guess one question I always have to both my own older brother and older siblings in general is, like, how do you know? Like you said, like, okay, so you're, how much older are you than your brother? A couple of years?
Yes, I'm about 3.5 years older than him.
All right, so you guys are close enough to, like, be in the same schools at the same times and everything. It's like, you're not so much further ahead that it's like, oh, I have all this wisdom and knowledge and, like, 10 years of perspective. It's like, hey, like, I just sort of stumbled through this, and, like, here's a way you cannot trip over your own shoelaces, like, as you do it. Is it like, a struggle, I guess, like, having to maintain that sense of, like, role modelness when, like, you're still a kid, right? You know what I mean? It's like, you're 14, 15, 16 years old. It's not like you have it all figured out, but you're still trying to set the path for this, you know, 10, 11, 12, 13-year-old coming up behind you. What's kind of like that dynamic? Like, how are you figuring yourself out in the meantime?
Well, you know, I can only speak from what I experienced ahead of him. I was learning a lot about the world that we were both growing up in, and anything that I did learn, I'd have to pass along. So, you know, I guess going back to, I introduced him to the internet, to how to, you know, research topics and, you know, how to keep in touch with people. You know, taught him how to play sports. And you know what? My younger brother wound up teaching me a lot over the years as well. Like, he's a very dedicated person to, you know, he's really attentive to personal health and personal hygiene. And I've learned a lot from him about that, like going to the gym, how to work out. You know, He's essentially, at this point, he's the stronger, better looking version of me. so I guess it worked out okay.
Oh yeah, I mean, the student becomes the teacher at some point, right?
Yeah.
And obviously you mentioned your mom is at home, like, your whole childhood, and so one of the things that I find holds true no matter kind of what the circumstances are is, like, if you have a stay-at-home parent, you have another parent who's working, you're undoubtedly extremely close with the stay-at-home parent. And especially if you have a younger sibling, it's like the two of you are kind of helping to co-parent in some sense. Like, obviously your dad's around, but, like, when you, one parent works 60 hours a week and, like, you are the other man in the house kind of looking out for the younger boy in the house, there's kind of a sense of kind of co-parenting. So what was, like, your relationship with your mom, like, were you able to kind of have a traditional kind of, like, child mother relationship, or are you kind of helping be kind of that leadership figure in the house?
I'd say my mother is the best part of my young life. She was always a source of inspiration. She was always a source of, she set goals for me and helped me set my goals and made sure that I achieved them. So like I did pretty well growing up in school, and she was an important part of making sure I stayed focused on learning and developing self-improvement. So I'm really thankful for that. And she was the leader growing up. So yeah, that relationship continues today. You know, I'm really close with my parents, and she's still a source of inspiration for me. She's still a person that makes sure that I realize what's important in life. Mm. You know, family, relationships with friends, and self-improvement. So I'm really thankful to her for that.
So that actually provides a nice little segue, because I'm curious. Obviously, like I said, grew up in a very Sicilian community. I get that family on most people's list I know is first, second, third, fourth, and fifth. But I guess bumping down to sixth on that list, like who are those people outside your family who you're closest to? Like who are those circles of friends? Like who are those relationships that like young Russ, adolescent, high schoolish Russ is kind of surrounding himself with and kind of influencing you as you kind of, stumble your way towards adulthood here?
So my wife obviously is very important to me. And
you guys met all the way back then? You mentioned you guys are both from Staten Island. I didn't know if you knew each other like when you were kids too.
Well, yeah, actually, it's actually a really funny story about how we met. So senior year in high school, I sat behind her in American history course. And basically the teacher had to separate us because I was doing nothing but flirting with her and talking to her and like essentially just distracting her in the classroom. And so the teacher put me in the back of the classroom, and we stayed friends throughout high school and college, and we never had a romantic relationship until years down the line when we met randomly at the Jersey Shore. And
this is getting classic right here. All right, so we're down the shore for the weekend, having a couple of mudslides.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm not big into the frozen drinks, but maybe a few. Yeah, we had a beer together. We reconnected down at the Jersey Shore, and this is about 6 years ago now that we reconnected there, and I asked her on a date, took her out on a date, and it's been pretty great ever since.
So what you mentioned you guys stayed in touch kind of in between that time. What was you guys' relationship like between, I guess like 17 and 26 here? You have like 9 years where you're like, hey, there's this girl I was super into in high school, like one that got away. Like, are you like thinking about it at all? Or are you just like, yeah, whatever, like that didn't work out. And then just like 10 years later, you have to like, oh, like, you're still pretty cool. I guess we still talk. We both like the same things in the same places.
Yeah. I mean, like we stay connected on Facebook, and we kept in touch through a couple messages here and there over the years. And I think we had some mutual friends that we hung out with a few times. Right. But we were friends, and
So that begs the immediate question then. Did you really run into her on the shore, or did you see her on Facebook going to the shore and you went to the shore?
No. So the week before we met up at the shore, like we ran into each other, I had seen her at a bar with a bunch of her friends. Hmm. And, I caught up and then I checked her like her Facebook status, and it said in a relationship. So I was like, oh, all right, she's in a relationship. She's in a relationship, so whatever. I'll just she's a friend. So, and then I actually found out that her Facebook wasn't updated, so she was single.
I feel like is the perennial crisis of our time. Is your Facebook relationship status real?
Yeah, it's not official until it's on Facebook, and then yes, it's a big thing to go back to single on Facebook.
Oh God, yeah.
And then, yeah, but it was completely random. The next weekend, neither of us had planned a meeting up, but it was completely random. I was waiting online, and I just heard her like she shouted, "Russ, is that you?" Like from like 10 people behind me, and yeah, it was completely random.
And so I, out of curiosity, you know, obviously there is still that big gap there of, you know, 8 or 9 years. Who are your friends that you are surrounding yourself with kind of in that period? Because obviously that's, you know, you graduate high school, you end up going to undergrad and then eventually law school. Like who are the people you're kind of like surrounded by and influenced kind of during that era of your life? You know, before you meet your wife and, you know, she takes over most of your life.
So I went to school in New Jersey at Seton Hall.
Ooh,
in
South Pirates. Orange.
Go Pirates, yeah. And so I met a lot of new friends at college. You know, the people I dormed with, the people that you go to classes with and stuff. And I also, of course, kept in touch with my friends from high school back in Staten Island. And it's just like the more people we come in touch with, the more we learn about the world, really. I mean, the thing that's great about college is there's people from all around the state and from all different parts of the country, you know, coming together for the common purpose of getting an education, making ourselves better. And I made a lot of friends in classes. I made a lot of friends socially in college. So, yeah.
And I guess I'm curious, are those friends you're meeting, you know, you went away for college, but obviously not like super, super far away from home. That being said, like you said, college is kind of this melting pot, mixed bag experience for most college campuses. Seton Hall, certainly no exception there, especially compared to Staten Island. So like, is your first year on campus like, oh, like I lived near New York City, but I spent a ton of time in Manhattan. Like I don't have friends of all these different walks of life. Was there any kind of like aha moment like that for you in college, or were you kind of coming in kind of, you know, open doors like, hey, like, you know, I'm cool with everybody, it's all good?
So I went to college to get an education, also meet new people. You're exactly right. It's people from all walks of life with all different opinions, with all different nationalities. And it's a beautiful thing. It's, you know, I went to college with the intent on learning as much about the world and the people from everywhere. So it was a great experience. I wouldn't trade for anything in the world, really.
Just out of curiosity, what did you study in undergrad? What did you study at Seton Hall? Or you do pre-law?
So I had a business major.
Okay.
Declared, I think, the second year. And no, I only took one business law class during undergrad, but I knew that I loved it, and I knew that something about it just like really spoke to me.
Also, just circling back on kind of the diversity of that experience, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you. So you go off to college, you know, you're dorming with a whole bunch of people. You know, I got, you know, a Mexican friend over here, a Cambodian friend over there, a Nigerian friend over here. You're Italian, you're from New York City, I know you're a prideful guy, you explain yourself that way. Did anyone have food that competes? Did anyone have food that competes with back home? Italian grandma back on Staten Island. Like, there's a lot of culture out there. There's a lot of food in the world. But I don't know if you found anything that really topped what you were coming from.
Oh, man. My grandmother, my nona make the best food on the planet.
All right. I figured that would hold up. I'm curious, out of that whole like pool of friends that you kind of grew throughout your college years, and I would imagine, you know, also during your L1, L2 years in law school, how many of them are kind of still influences in your life? Like, how many of them are, you know, helping with the campaign or kind of supporting, you know, current day Russ?
Oh, a lot of them. Hmm. A lot of my connections from college and law school have been involved in the campaign somewhere or another. One of my closest friends I met in undergrad, and he went to a different law school than I did, but we're still in touch, and he helps me out a lot. And it's so incredible how people that even if I haven't like spoken to in a few years, like once I tell them about the campaign, about what we're doing here in New Jersey, they get involved almost immediately, and they're excited about me running. They're excited to be involved. And yeah.
Have you had any that you kind of reach out to, like, you know, hoping or expecting that reaction that kind of got the opposite? Like, you know, hey, we hadn't talked in a few years and I don't know, you know, they became, you know, a Trump supporter over that course of those years, or that, you know, they really like turned or soured on, you know, something, you know, maybe as a obviously central platform plank of your campaign, whether that's, you know, the Green New Deal stuff, or the, you know, Medicare for All stuff. Is there anyone who you kind of reach out to is like, hey man, like, love you. Yeah, we had a lot of good times together, but like, I think this is where I got to jump off the train.
So some people express, you know, their counter viewpoints. So like basically I tell people I'm a progressive Democrat and I'm fighting for a government that actually listens to the people. And, you know, I think corporate money in politics is a huge problem. And like 99% of people agree with that. I'd say 99% of people say that corporations have too much political influence over our elections, and they want to return to a fair system, an open and equal election system. Other people differ with, you know, different ways on how to get there. A lot of people are concerned about when we mention things like Medicare for All, Green New Deal. They're concerned about their taxes, how much taxes they pay. They're concerned about also a lot of people support Trump, and I think some people that support Trump have like a tribal mentality where they're like, oh, I'm on team red and I just can't support anybody on team blue. So yeah, some people have like expressed that, but I have found that I can break through that wall with discussing how corruption shapes both parties, how corruption shapes all of our politics. And then they have essentially an epiphany like, wow, man, you know, on that issue alone, it's worth supporting and worth coming on board. So,
And so the tribalist mentality is very real, obviously. I think we're all experiencing that in some form or another right now. Are you having as much success breaking that down for people? You know, obviously, say it's, you know, like I mentioned, you know, one of your friends from college or even high school, or some, you know, who's now just staunchly team red, but then you have that conversation with them and they're like, all right, like, listen, I'm team red, but like I can support what you're trying to do here, and like even I understand that corruption in politics is a bad thing, right? Like but you mentioned 99% of people agree with that. I think the other 1% probably own a corporation, so like that's that makes a lot of sense to me. But are you having that same level of success kind of converting people who you don't have that personal relationship or don't have that kind of connection or background with?
Mitch, great question, because, you know, you wouldn't believe it, but I have people who voted for Trump that are consider themselves conservative Democrats volunteering for our campaign because they agree on this issue. Because even, you know, if you want to be honest with ourselves and you even look at what Trump is doing, he's doing a massive amount of self-dealing for himself. You know, like his companies have earned hundreds of millions of dollars by him just going playing golf off of, and the federal government is paying it, which is insane. It's a conflict of interest. It's a for-profit presidency, and people even sign on for that reason as well. So yeah, we are breaking through with even people that I don't have like a personal connection with beforehand.
All right, I want to pivot here and ask you a couple of little lighter questions before we wrap up the first half of this year and then dive into the back half. One of the things I always love to ask everybody, you know, you painted your friends in a very nice and seemingly positive light here. You know, all your friends from high school, all your friends from college, they all sound like great, wonderful, upstanding people who are awesome influences in your life. So to try and knock that down a peg, let me ask this. What was your first like vice or bad habit, and which of those friends introduced you to it?
Ooh, my first bad habit, smoking cigarettes, actually, tobacco. Huh. Yeah.
I would have really thought that went out of vogue like in our generation, but it is surprising how many people like still do or did at some point. You're like the second or third person who said that, and all of them were candidates. So apparently, being involved in politics is very stressful, and you need a cigarette.
Well, I wasn't even involved in politics yet, but you know, it's like it's literally after the first cigarette, you can become addicted, and it's so highly addictive, and it's the marketing. I think the marketing at that time, you know, I do remember like seeing like Joe Camel ads, you know, on billboards and stuff.
You want your leather jacket and your sunglasses and your pack of Joe Cools.
yeah, like that was my first bad advice. And thankfully, my wife was a huge influence on me with quitting. So
my girlfriend, soon to be wife, is following her lead. I forgot the follow up to that. Who introduced you to it? Like who was the first person who like gave you a cigarette? Who are your buddies like smoking out, you know, behind the school with? Who are these people?
So I was never smoking like at school, but I think I was 18 years old when I first had my cigarette. And yeah, one of my high school buddies introduced me to it.
Went and bought like a porno from the corner store and a pack of cigarettes. At 18th birthday.
No, it wasn't like that. It was basically like hanging out. You'd go out for a smoke break and I'd go hang out with him. And I was like, oh, let me try one of those. And he was like, you sure? I don't think you should.
Famous last words,
right? And, yeah, famous last words. Like, all right, one can't hurt. And then one turns, one, honestly, it's crazy how addictive they are.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's a product designed to keep you hooked and smoking until, you know, the year end days.
Which is a terrifying prospect. And not only that, but like your end days will also be much worse if that is the case. So I'm happy for you that you quit.
Thanks, man.
I have the other couple I had for you, on the funner end of things. I'm always just curious, how'd you kind of decide where to go to college? So obviously you ended up at Seton Hall. It sounds like college was always in the cards for you. Like you were a good student and, you know, had plenty of extracurriculars and your application wasn't going to hurt pretty much anywhere. How'd you kind of make the decision to end up at Seton Hall?
Interesting story. So at the time, you know, the popular opinion was you need a college degree to be competitive
for sure
in this world. And I remember my guidance counselor explicitly saying, just go to the best school that you can get into, that don't worry too much about the student loans because you'll pay them off.
And Talk about famous last words. Jesus.
Famous last words. Yeah. And actually I even got a half scholarship to Seton Hall.
Okay.
And I think his tuition was still like 20 grand a year. Or close to like 15 grand a year was still tuition. And then if you add up all the other costs of college, like dorming and food plans and textbooks, it's very expensive.
Oh, yeah.
But the scholarship really helped my decision. And also I visited a bunch of college campuses and I really liked the Seton Hall campus. So yeah, I went there because they also had a very, very good business school.
That makes a lot of sense to me. That's probably one of the more rational stories of that I've heard. and the last two are very easy, I promise you. First and foremost, where's your nickname come from? I assume Russ is short for something, or is it just Russ?
Yeah, my full name is Russell.
Okay, that's what I figured.
And I like Russ better. It's more personal, and it's easier to remember.
Who started calling you Russ? Like, who's the first person who called you Russ?
Definitely not my mom.
I take it your mom still very much does not appreciate the Russ. You're Russell in that house.
I know that I'm in trouble if I hear my full name coming out of my mom's mouth. Yeah. But yeah, my dad called me Russ. My dad goes by Russ. So,
oh, all right.
Yeah, it's in the family.
Nice. All right. And then the last one is a question I stole from my third favorite podcast, a podcast called It's a Waste of Time with It's the Real. They ask everybody, and it seems to always result in a pretty decent story. So I will ask you, who is the most famous person you went to high school with? Or if there's no famous people, you know, just somebody you want to shout out and somebody cool.
The most famous person?
Might be you at this point. I don't know.
No, it's definitely not me yet. But I graduated with Ali Ogbu. He played for the Indianapolis Colts.
Oh, no kidding.
As a lineman. Yeah. Huh. And there was another guy that set a record for Jeopardy. I forgot his name. I'll have to look him up.
Not Ken Jennings, I assume.
No, not Ken.
Okay. Sorry, I recently started a Jeopardy like binge when they added them to Netflix. I'm fully addicted now, so I'm working my way through like all the old episodes of Jeopardy and learning a ton. So I'll keep an eye out for your buddy.
All right, cool.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So we're going to take a quick break here. We're going to come back and jump into the second half of the interview called I Am One of Those People. We're going to get into political people. So I want to talk to you a little bit about being a progressive, kind of a working class Democrat, if you will, and all your other political ideologies and identities. So we're going to take a quick break here and we'll be right back.
I'm one of those people.
All right, we are back with the second half of our interview. This is a segment I like to call I Am One of Those People. On this volume of Those People, the podcast, we are going to explore those political people. So obviously today with me, I have a candidate for Congress, which is just about as political as you can get. He is also a lot of other types of people, though. He's a father, he's a husband, he's a champion of the underdog. As far as a political person, he calls himself a Democratic Socialist and a Progressive Democrat. He's a working American, as he mentioned in our first half. He's also a student who's still in debt and a concerned citizen above all else, who's kind of got some concerns for America and his brothers and sisters across this country. So we want to jump in and I guess talk a little bit about your political identity as a political person. And I want to start off with asking, I guess, what exactly is a Democratic Socialist in your eyes? Because I know a lot of people listening at home, they hear the dirty S word, right? And their eyes roll and they're like, socialists are bad and they're no better than Mother Russia and they're all coming to, take over America as we know it. And then you hear the word democratic next to it, and you're like, well, that sounds like everything I was told is good. So what exactly is a democratic socialist? And like, how do you make sense of that for people who are kind of new to that movement or new to those terms?
So you're right. The first word democratic is the most important word, right? Mm. What does democratic mean? Democratic means we all get to vote on specific issues. Our government is supposed to be a representative democracy, and it has the authority to govern our lives and make decisions for us because we get to vote at least once a year, and at least we have that say in who leads us. And democracy at its core is about citizens caring about other citizens. It's about Americans caring about other Americans. Not only do we have a responsibility to better our individual lives, we also have a responsibility to better how our public and how our government works. And, there has always been the one percenters really have always attacked the word socialism but to me, socialism means society comes first. It means that together we decide democratically how we allocate our public resources so that we can make life better for all people in America. And I love the Shakespearean quote that says, "What's in a name? A rose by any other name is just as sweet." Because the label doesn't matter as much as the content, the sweetness. If we're faced with a bunch of generational crises right now, if we have to be honest with ourselves, we have to say, look, we have issues right now, and we can fix them with good government, with government that serves the public, that serves the common good. And that's what it really means to me. I personally like the term progressive better because it says that in its name, we're making American progress. But I also like the term democratic socialist because I am a member of the Democratic Socialists. But really, don't judge based on the name. Judge on the ideas of what we're talking about here. Because if you look at what we have now, we have crises, but we also have corporate dominance of our private lives in America today. Corporations govern our lives for their benefit, for their profit. Corporations make decisions for us that we don't have any accountability over. They're not accountable to us. They make decisions in boardrooms. That's more like a monarchy to me than it is a democracy. I think we need more democracy in the workplace, more democracy in our decisions about the economy, and it will result in liberating us as people. So that's what it means to me, really.
I tend to agree with a large swath of that. And I think my idea of America, like my American identity, if you will, is one that is more leaning towards freedom and democracy and representation and, small R republicanism, right? Like we're all represented by, this republic that, takes care of us and believes in, to borrow all of your terms here, progress for the greater society. So I'm on board with all of that. However, there is kind of this flip side of the American identity, which is, you know, freedom and individuality and individual liberty and entrepreneurship and, you know, individual exceptionalism. And I think the pushback from a lot of people, not necessarily myself, but a lot of people who kind of disagree with the tenets of socialism, is that you sacrifice the ability for any one individual to succeed in such a way that it is motivating to separate them from the rest of society. I don't necessarily see that as a bad thing, because I think we should all be on the same team here. But also, I understand that, like, competition is human nature and, you know, has obviously driven some of our greatest innovation, right? And so how do you kind of ration out where the line is on that between, like, well, we have to do what's good for all people versus we have to motivate people to be able to come up with what's good for all people? Because, you know what I mean? Like, there is a balance there.
Mm-hmm.
Down version is, you know, you can't just give everybody everything for free because nobody will work. I don't obviously believe that, but I do believe there's a tipping point where it's like, well, if I make over, say, $50 million a year and you tax me at 90%, well, I'm only going to find a way to make $49 million a year now. Like, I'm good on making $52 million a year, because what's the point? You know what I mean? And while that in and of itself, mm-hmm, I think is good and, like, useful and will help, you know, redistribute the economy, it also does make those same people be like, well, I don't need to make another $10 million because it doesn't do me any good anyway. And so now I'm not going to innovate on this product. I'm not going to change something that's been working for a number of years just for the sake of trying to make more money. And those things aren't going to stimulate the economy or create jobs or create progress the same way that they are now. What's kind of, how do you make sense of that tension, that conflict between the entrepreneurship of it and kind of like the caring and compassion for the greater society?
So there's a lot to unpack there. So we'll go one bit by bit.
Yeah, sorry, that's a very long question.
So first, when we say, you know, individualism, right? Mm. It's a little spoken about fact, but our private lives depend on the public and the common good. For us to be free individually, we need a strong public that is protecting and empowering all of us equally. And it is, you're right, there has to be careful balance, right? So when we speak about freedom, I'm talking about freedom from corporate servitude, because right now, most of us work for large multinational corporations that we dedicate our lives to these corporations, and we're not getting enough back from them that will help us fulfill our personal liberty, right? So in terms of healthcare, liberty and the pursuit of happiness, both of those require health. If those are inalienable rights in our Declaration of Independence, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, all of those require us to be healthy. We have to be healthy people to pursue happiness. In order to live a fulfilling life, we have to be healthy. And right now, the healthcare industry infringes on our freedom, because they decide who we could see as a doctor, what services we can get, what insurance will cover for our pharmaceutical drugs, what prescriptions we can afford. They decide it without us. And they have no accountability to us. They only care about privatization and profits. The only way they make profits is by denying people life-saving healthcare insurance, freedom from these corporate middlemen that make decisions for our health behind boardrooms and closed doors.
Well, I think that's part of it, though, that I want to jump in on, because I think it's an easy argument to make when you're talking about, say, a life and death circumstance like healthcare, right? Or like education, where I think most people generally agree that, like, you know, education should be public, should be funded, should be equitable, should be even. But then when you start looking at things like, say, guns, that becomes a lot more tense, or something like, you know, regulations on cars and emissions, right? Where it's like, you know, it is in the interest of the greater society that we figure these things out. But also it may be in tension with some people's bottom lines and or motivations to be able to expand and kind of, you know, I guess do with their lives and their companies and their monies and their like resources, what they'd want to do with it. So I think that's an easy kind of line to draw when you're talking about, say, healthcare, like you mentioned, because like, yeah, obviously like some company lording my ability to live over me for a dollar is a shitty thing. And I think anyone who doesn't see it that way is kind of a moron, right? Like, I don't think there's a ton of us who are conflicted about that, but I think it becomes a lot tougher when it's like, say, gun manufacturers, right? And it's like, well, I don't know exactly how many guns we should or should not have. I don't know which guns we should or should not have. I don't know how to make those decisions because I am not a gun person, but I also believe in gun control. So, like, where is that line between, like, you know, gun manufacturers have a right to create new guns and new weapons and new technologies and new ideas and to charge whatever they want for them?
So I say this often, government's role is to protect us equally. It's to protect the citizens, right? And right now we see these mass shootings occurring at a way, way, way too high rate. So we as a society need to protect each other from the gun violence, from the, I like to call gun regulations mass murder prevention plan, right? So I think the proper balance would be to do what other countries have done in response to mass shootings that have actually fixed their problems. So Australia is a really great example because they created a gun buyback program and banned assault weapons. So we can follow a model like that. There are solutions to these problems because we know other countries have found them. We should draw from those policies as well. They can apply to America. So basically, why are gun manufacturers allowed to sell to anybody without any investigation into who's buying it, what they intend on doing with it? Like, that infringes on our liberty, our pursuit of happiness, when we just let the gun manufacturers sell to whoever they want without looking into who they're selling to. I think society as a whole, you know, our role is to balance those public protections with the private liberties as well. And it's a very difficult question, but there are solutions to it that have worked. Like I said, a lot of the reasons why entrepreneurship is a dwindling like opportunity for a lot of people is because health insurance is tied to your employer. And if you want to start your own business, it's going to be your biggest expense for your employees. Second, it's going to be the biggest expense for yourself. If we guarantee healthcare coverage as a right, we'll see more entrepreneurship, more people being able to take a risk and start a business. So I think that we could promote entrepreneurship with various policies that require a strong government.
So what it sounds like to me is kind of where the distinction for you is kind of where this becomes, where it either infringes on the general public's right to liberty and happiness, or where it becomes a matter of life and death, right? Like, that is where the government should step in and intervene on behalf of society. But beyond that, you're pretty much okay with, you know, the private citizens and the private market, if you will. You know, for instance, going back to the gun control example, it's like we should require background checks. We should have a nationalized policy on, like, essentially how you get a gun. But beyond that, we shouldn't, say, regulate, yeah, like, which gun manufacturers make which guns or how many guns that you can have or which guns are allowed in which places.
So I'm a gun owner. I own guns, and I believe that we should have an assault weapons ban. I believe that we should have universal background checks, red flag laws, because those will protect us. I believe that the government's role is to empower us. So we're in situations where the free market, quote unquote, isn't working for the vast majority of people, it's the government's role to make sure that we fill those gaps and that no one is left behind. So that's why I support a federal jobs guarantee, because if there's a lot of good work to do, we need to be done, and we should pay people to do it. Like, we need to build more schools, we need to build more bridges, rebuild our roads, we have to build more, we have to go 100% renewable energy by 2030. And these are the things that we have to do as a species, as a planet, as a country. And it is the government's role to make sure that it happens.
I guess what's your plan for that? Because I know there's a lot of variations of that. I guess most famously to me, sticking out is Pete Buttigieg's and previously before he dropped out, Seth Moulton's kind of campaign for a commitment to national service outside of the military. So like reestablishing national service programs, whether that's, you know, building green energy projects or figuring out new technologies or figuring out more sustainable food processes. So what would you like to kind of enact here in Jersey that would kind of be trending in that direction of kind of getting more people invested in solving these big problems? Because I agree with you. I think we need more people, not just the government, but more people believing in their government and participating in their government to make those things possible.
So I think that we have to encourage, you know, opportunities for everyone. And I support the Green New Deal, and I support Bernie Sanders' plan for the Green New Deal because it has a federal jobs guarantee that will prioritize investing and building our renewable, limitless, clean energy of the future. And it will provide jobs training, and it will provide billions and billions of dollars for New Jersey to invest in renewable energy like windmill farms, solar panel farms, because, you know, these are natural, renewable, limitless energy sources that are present every day. So we could generate power from just the sun. The sun's always going to be there, and we could generate power from that. But we need to create millions of jobs in New Jersey to do so. We need to build these farms, and we should have them owned by the people who are there, worker cooperatives, and even owned by the communities in which we build them, because they are the ones that will prioritize providing cheap, clean energy to their communities. So these are all democratically principled organizations. And, you know, science has said that we have to go 100% renewable by 2030 if we have any future on this planet. I also think that, you know, the Green New Deal takes its name from the New Deal with FDR. And during the New Deal, we had to get out of the Great Depression. So FDR was willing to commit and spend 40% of America's GDP on beating the Great Depression through public works projects, the Civilian Conservation Corps. And we actually built a lot of cool things in New Jersey, too. Like, we built a lot of hospitals. We built the Rutgers Stadium that still exists today. We built lots of roads and bridges. Like, and we employed 1 million people in New Jersey, and most of these people were youth, 18 to 22 years old.
One of the things I like to drill down on a little bit, like when people mention anything is jobs related, but specifically as it regards to the Green New Deal, so I feel like a lot of people hear that and they're like, okay, well, that sounds great for some kid who's going to be getting out of college in a couple of years to go get like his wind farm job or whatever. But like, what jobs can I get that, like, where is my job going in? Like, if these are the good new jobs, like, who are the people who should be targeting those jobs? Because often, like, that is the pushback, right? Like, I'm a coal miner, I work at a gas station, I work wherever, and you're telling me that, like, my job is hurting the country and the world, and that I need to go get some new job that you haven't told me exists or I can train for yet. So who are those people who, like, should be kind of looking into this now and who might, you know, have an opportunity to kind of break into this field and get in early? Because I feel like a lot of people listening are like, hey man, like I'd be on board if you can just show me a path. But until you can show me a path, like you said, like I'm married to my employer, I'm married to my health insurance, I'm married to being able to put food on the table. And so those are like real kind of kitchen table issues for a lot of people. So who are those people you see kind of transitioning into this economy?
Well, I see a lot of people who work in the fossil fuel industry now will get the first shot at the job training. You know, it's going to even be paid job training, I think. And, so they'll be able to get the knowledge that they need to work in the environment, in the renewable energy sector. And it's not just going to be like construction jobs. It's going to also be administrative jobs, planning jobs, engineering jobs, all sorts of new jobs that we need to transition to this renewable energy sector. And it's going to ensure a just transition for everybody who is going to be displaced by moving away from fossil fuels. Because the problem is, it's not with the people who work in the fossil fuel industry. They're amazing. The problem is that the fossil fuel corporations produce one product that strangles our environment and pollutes the air that my child breathes. It pollutes the drinking water that our children have to drink. And we know that we're approaching the climate crisis turning point. You know, this is personal to me because not only my son's future depends on it, but my house in Old Bridge is actually predicted by 2035 to be experiencing bi-weekly flooding. So that means every time that I get a paycheck, my house will be flooding. So this is a real crisis that we're facing, and this is about an evolution to the future, an evolution from this old, dirty fossil fuel product that we haven't been able to evolve from, because basically the billionaires that own the fossil fuel companies just know one thing: make more money, make more money, make more money. They don't care about the environment. They don't care about the people who have to breathe the polluted air. And we know that that's true because we see worldwide that they operate with blatant disregard for the communities that they affect. Like, and they don't even report to us the true environmental issues that they cause. Like, we know Exxon knew about the carbon pollution climate crisis since the 70s. We know that Deepwater Horizon didn't report on the leak, the full extent of the leak, till you know there were national cameras on them. We know in Dakota they recently tried to hide a massive oil spill that's almost the size of the Exxon Valdez spill. They said it was only 10 gallon a leak. Turns out it was 10 million gallons. Like, we can't
just a slight typo there. I just missed the M.
Yeah. Like, we can't trust these companies to lead us to a future that protects us from the climate crisis. And we just need a new program to get us there.
I tend to agree with you. I tend to agree with the DSA outlook on things, which is that, like, the crisis is well in upon us, and, like, we might survive if we do everything possible, and that's kind of the place we're in now, and I don't think a lot of people are kind of seeing it on that level. I do think, like you mentioned, it is helpful to kind of draw for people a future they can see themselves in, and understanding that, like you said, it's not just going to be all people laying brick and, you know, paving roads like the old New Deal was, if you will. Like, the Green New Deal is going to involve a whole bunch of other jobs, right? It's going to involve call center jobs and admin jobs and healthcare jobs and, you know, caretaker jobs and construction jobs and sales jobs and all these different types of people who maybe, you know, can't see themselves walking away from what they're doing now. And I think there will be a place for them. I just think I think it's a little fuzzy depending on how these next couple elections go, when that will happen, and when you can ask people to make that move. And so that might be the trickiest part of that transition. I do want to take a couple minutes here and dive a little bit more into kind of your political identity, kind of personally, not just the things that you're running on and the things that you're hoping to enact, you know, as policy here. And I'm curious, you kind of went over why you find it important to call yourself a democratic socialist, but when was kind of the first time you became an activist or a kind of a political person in general? Like, how did you get involved in politics? Was it through the DSA, or were you, like, always this far left, or was this, like, a slow trickle left, or, like, what was your entry point into political
theater? Well, if you want to go back really far, you know, I was a freshman in high school when 9/11 happened, and I just didn't understand.
Across the
street. Yeah, like, a few miles away, the worst tragedy in American history in recent memory occurred. You know, and that really shattered my worldview. Like, wow, somebody would do this to us? Like, why? And, you know, as you start looking at the history of our nation, you know, you look with the birth of the internet, there's a much more information available. And I just saw that, like, for the vast majority of our history, a lot of people have struggled. A lot of people have suffered. A lot of people have been denied equal rights. And to me, like, at my core, that just shakes me to my core. Like, we're a nation founded upon principles of every person is equal. And in reality, the practical aspects, we haven't lived up to that promise. And that's fundamentally at odds with who I am as a person. So, like, doing research, right? I read Howard Zinn's book, History of America. I was starting to look into FDR and what he did for our country. And I just realized that something has to change. It has to get better for the future. That was really, really far down. I guess, 18 years ago at this point, right? So that really makes your question, that really made me question what got us into that, this mess. And then, you know, the war in the Middle East was really honestly world shattering, because we decided to go to war after, you know, after being attacked. And essentially, like, my entire adult life, our country has been in the Middle East and at war. And I'm just think we spent so much of our discretionary budget on these illegal occupations worldwide. And I call them illegal occupations because Congress has not declared war. And our Constitution says that only Congress has the right to declare war, but we have been in a war for 16 years at this point, right?
Yeah. And so is it kind of that anti-war activism that's kind of shaping, I guess, like your young political identity? Like what actions are you, like, what are you involved in as far as kind of like these anti-war sentiments? Cause like I said, we're pretty close in age around that same time. My older brother, lent me his copy of Howard Zinn's People's Guide to American History. And so I'm very much kind of coming of age on that same circuit. And so I'm curious kind [S2] Yeah. [S1] Of like how involved are you in kind of the, because I remember at the time being a couple years younger than you, I had a very different sense of it, right? I have almost this, like, you know, what great American heroes who are signing up to, you know, go fight this war and, like, take the fight to the terrorist. And, you know, I'm standing on my feet saluting the flag when baseball comes back after 9/11 and, like, all the, you know, the propaganda that works for children, you know what I mean? And so as somebody a couple years older than me, and then also obviously like kind of growing in the early stages of that, seeing, you know, I would imagine some of your friends, some of your classmates go off to that war, maybe some of them not coming home.
Mm-hmm.
What are the first kind of actions you're taking to get involved in politics? And I guess when did it dawn on you that maybe it was just time to be a politician?
Well, so I guess we'll start with the point I decided to get involved as a politician was, you know, I have a 2-year-old son, and like I said, his future depends on how we can deal with the current crisis now. And when the Green New Deal resolution was passed in the House, I was really excited. Like, it's a legitimate plan to bring us to 100% renewables. And my representative, who represents me for 27 plus years, essentially laughed at the plan. He said, it's not politically possible. It's not technologically possible. And at that point, when he chose to represent his fossil fuel companies over his constituents, he became the greatest threat to my family and to my son. And at that point, I decided this guy's got to go. And doing more research into his background, it became clear that he would never, ever have any sane environmental policy to protect my son's air, water, and environment.
This is Frank Pallone you're talking about, yes?
Yeah, Frank Pallone's the incumbent. And, you know, he takes money from fossil fuel companies. He takes money from TransCanada, Duke, Dominion, all the biggest polluters in our country. And he actually, you know, he's not taking action on anything. And, you know, there's even a proposed fracked gas pipeline running through my township in Old Bridge that, you know, that I don't want to see a new pipeline in my township. I moved to New Jersey because I thought we had clean air and, you know, we had some environmental protections.
Who told you that about New Jersey? I had to get that one in, man.
It's the Garden State. And, you know, doing more research into where we live, the air quality gets an F from the American Lung Association, which means they suggest not doing any strenuous outdoor activities for a long period of time, over half an hour,
wow,
like an hour or something. Yeah, it's really ridiculous. Like, so I protested that pipeline, and from there on, I've just been completely dedicated to running for Congress and getting in there so we could put a moratorium on new fossil fuel projects, so we could have the courage to stand up to the fossil fuel industry and, you know, protect our environment. I mean, I was even, like, before getting into this race, I was a member of the county committee in where I grew up in Richmond County. I was a committee member, and, you know, we did the normal democratic things over there at county level. Mm. I've been getting involved in local politics as an activist most recently. My township, Old Bridge, just voted to sue Governor Murphy to try and get allow ICE to do raids in Old Bridge. Hmm. So I spoke out at that meeting, and my protest fell on deaf ears. The resolution passed like 7-2. I just don't think that we need Old Bridge to keep us safe. I don't think we need Old Bridge to have ICE to keep us safe. I think our police department is doing a great job. Before that, I went to a few Occupy Wall Street protests, and.
Hey man, don't that? I'm an Occupy alum myself. I catch a lot of flack for that, but you're in safe space here, friend.
Yeah, well, I mean, at the time, I just thought it was insane that people were foreclosed upon in 2008 because they were essentially preyed upon by these predatory banks that sold them terrible mortgages, terrible balloon mortgages, right? And then the banks get bailed out, but then people could still lose their homes. I didn't understand that at all. That made no sense to me. It struck me to my core, like, that's unfair.
Couldn't agree more. It sounds like a lot of kind of your platform and your ideology is almost kind of steeped in that Occupy generation of, like, anti-political corruption, greener both energy and just, like, lifestyles for the future of our country, combating climate change, equal rights for all. I guess one of the things I'm curious about, I don't know a ton about Jersey politics, but you mentioned Frank Pallone. He's been in office almost as long as I've been alive. His idea mm-hmm. of, climate change and climate policy is like a clean cars deal where we, reduce the amount of fossil fuels that most automobiles make over the course of the next 10 years. Obviously, that's not going to get it done. But, you live in a place that is represented by a guy like that, that is protesting or lobbying for and suing for to have ICE come in and, like, extract people from their homes. I guess, like, put bluntly, that this is not my personal opinion, as I don't live in New Jersey, so I don't have a horse in the race. But, like, how exactly are you planning on winning there? Because it doesn't exactly sound like the place that's super open to a lot of what you mentioned. Obviously, your anti-corruption platform turns a lot of people, but then a lot of the mm-hmm. other things you stand for, whether that's the Green New Deal or equal rights for queer people or like a higher minimum wage, may not necessarily that may turn off some of those same people you might win over on the corruption argument. So what is the path you see towards winning your district?
So we're going to win this district in 2020. We're starting nice and early to get our name recognition up, and we're running in the primary. So it's an open primary, so people can register same day as a Democrat and vote in the primary. We have a lot of millennials and the youth that live in our district that are going to vote for us because we're talking about policies that benefit their world. We're talking about policies that benefit everyone in our district. And how do we do it? Our campaign is building the volunteer task force that we need to knock on every single door by June 2020.
Every single door in the district? That's the promise?
Well, there's 750,000 doors, but...
that's what I was going to say. You're going to need a lot of people, bro.
every person who is a Democrat will be knocking on their door.
All right.
And, we're building a movement out here. There's a lot of subgroups that are very progressive as well that agree with us and align with us. And people are very active here. I went to Frank Pallone's town hall. There were 300 people there. He must have fielded like 100 questions. Maybe 50 of them were about Medicare for All. Maybe like 30 of them were probably about impeachment. And a good swath of the other ones were about addressing climate crisis to the extent that we need to protect our environment. And, he failed on every single question in dealing with that person's concerns pretty much. He was unaware that the people who work in the health industry make less than, $15 an hour. He was unaware that disabled persons need full-time care. And he just really showed that he was kind of out of touch with what a lot of the people at the town hall meeting cared about. So I'm a completely different kind of leader than he is. I understand the role is partially legislation, and my attorney background will help me out with that. But most of the role is being on the ground, talking to people and listening to their concerns and actually supporting policies that will improve their lives.
That to me sounds like the road to victory, but only so far in as you're able to turn out a lot of, I guess, historically non-voters, whether that's people who are under 18 in the last election or people who hadn't voted previously or people who hadn't voted in a while. And it sounds like that's a big portion of kind of your plan, right? It's like, I'm going to knock on the doors of all the Democrats who stayed home in 2016, and I'm going to go find all the college kids who just turned 18 or are going to vote for the first time, you know, since, you know, the world went to shit 4 years ago. And I'm going to turn out all of those people. How do you feel about the people who, I guess, aren't super politically active, or I guess just feel disinvested one way or the other? Because I feel like that is most of those people, right? It is the guy working 60 hours a week as a line cook and then has to go do his second job driving Uber. And then by the time you knock on his door, he's just like, what are you? You're a politician? Like, I don't give a fuck, man. Like, I don't vote. Like, get out of my face. Like, how do you win those people over? Like, how do you, I guess, take away that apathy towards the process? Because that's essentially what you're relying on to win the vote, I would imagine, right? Like, if you turn out all the types of people you're talking about turning out, you're going to win in a landslide. But getting all of those people to show up and actually vote is quite the battle.
Yeah, you're right. And why, you know, it's really disheartening to me that people don't vote, but I understand where they're coming from, right? A lot of people that don't vote have told me I don't vote because they're both the same. Democrats and Republicans are the same. They take big money from corporations. They represent corporate lobbyists. And they're right. They're right.
Yeah.
What we're saying now is I'm a different kind of progressive Democrat, that I care about the people here. I'm not taking any corporate money. I'm not going to listen to any of these big dollar billionaire donors. They do not matter to me when it comes to the people. That's who I care about, the people in this district. And non-voters identify with that. That's why they'll be excited to get into this movement. That's why they'll be excited to go to the primary day and put somebody in Congress that will be fighting for a higher minimum wage, for free public college for all, for Medicare for all, for stronger unions, for more unions. We have an inspiring message because we need it now. We need a vision for America that calls for true representation of the people.
To pivot back a little bit to kind of your journey on this political process, what was kind of like, what was the moment you realized that was you? Because like you mentioned, like we do need a leader. We do need, you know, the legislation is great and the bills are great or whatever. But a big part of this is going to be communication and leading and listening and being able to enact all of that feedback that you're gathering in a meaningful way and in a way that other people in Congress are going to listen to and vote on. And that is the majority, in my opinion, of the job. I was talking to a state Senate candidate earlier this month about this as well. And so I think your calculation is correct, that like it is the inspiration that we need to kind of draw to those young people, to those disaffected people, to get them to turn out and vote. When did you realize that you thought you were that guy? Because like as someone who, you know, I record my opinions on the internet for a living, I talk a lot of shit on the internet, I have no problem putting myself out there. And even I still struggle to have that kind of hubris and self-confidence where I'm like, you know what the world needs? More Mitch. Mitch should run the country. And so like, how do you, like, when did you come to that conclusion? You were like, nah, like I think this is my time and I think this is me. And I think I'm the person cut out to do this.
Well, I guess a lot of that question will be answered by the people who are voting, right? Am I the person for them? So I just took a really good look at myself and my experience as an attorney for the public good, as a government housing attorney. I've experienced firsthand that, you know, big money and corporations have unlimited money to hire big fancy corporate attorneys in the courtrooms to argue for them. And, you know, I've stood up to those same people in courtrooms who argue the law doesn't apply to them. And that experience really has given me the courage to also stand up to them on a national level. And I'm going to be building on my public service experience, you know, to really speak the great truths of our nation that have to be spoken. So I have that experience. I have legislative experience. I've drafted a law that was just passed in June that protects tenants that live in manufactured homes. It protects them from predatory lenders. So I have legislative experience, and I think we need leaders that just have the courage to stand up to the big money in this country that just winds up buying our elections. And it's ultimately up to the people to decide if I'm that person, but my job right now is to make sure that they know I'm fighting for them. I want to fight for them in Congress, and I'm going to do my best.
Well, I certainly do. I think your message is certainly resonant, and at the very least, even on the things I don't necessarily agree with you on, I think your heart is certainly in the right place, and you're fighting for the right people and the right causes. I want to wrap this up here on a couple of my favorite questions to ask everybody just at the end of the interview, because what's life if none of these things happen? I guess who's the person you've met being politically active or being a politician even who's changed your life the most? Like what was like the person during this campaign or during this process of getting this off the ground that you were like, you know, I didn't know you before, but like, oh my God, like this would not be possible without this person.
So I haven't met him yet. but Bernie Sanders,
All right.
Bernie Sanders is definitely one of the people who've inspired me. I went to Netroots Nation a few weeks ago in Philly, and I met some people that were personal heroes of mine in the past, like Randy Bryce. He ran against Ryan, and there are a lot of people that have inspired me. I mean, even like a local councilwoman, she is an amazing voice for our community. She's very inspiring. I've been meeting just people that live in our district that their stories inspire me too. So like recently my friend Tom told me a story about him. He wanted to go to college. He actually went to college for 2 years, and then he decided he couldn't afford it anymore and he had to drop out. And, you know, he says that free public college would have really helped him out, and he would have gotten a different career path probably than he's on now. And he wishes that he had that opportunity. The people in our district are inspiring because they're passionate about politics, and they relate their own stories to us that really inspire me.
So I tend to ask that question before this next coming one, because every politician you sit down with will always say that the people in their district and meeting the people in their district is the best part of the campaign. I would hope that's true, regardless where you live. And, you know, that is part of representing your home district. I hope you like the people there. For instance, I just recently moved out of Ayanna's district myself, and being able to vote for her as a city councilwoman and then watching her then become our U.S. State representative was a pretty cool thing. And that I feel very inspired by her. But I always want to wrap every interview, no matter if I'm interviewing candidates or I'm interviewing, you know, rappers or authors or photographers or whoever else, but asking everybody kind of the same question, which is like, what's your favorite part about being this version of you? Like, what is your favorite part about being a candidate for Congress? Like Russ fighting to change America, like Russ, like trying to like be this version of yourself. Like, what do you love most about it?
I think it's really the pure joy, the pure feeling of joy and happiness that comes from standing up and fighting for what we believe in, you know, and linking all of us together on this common journey that we're all in this together. And it's just so activism is true joy, expressing yourself, you know, making sure that the powers that be understand that we're not just going to sit idly by and let them do whatever they want in the country. You know, we're fighting for justice for all, and our outlook of where our country is going to be in a few years is actually positive. There's light at the end of this Trump tunnel. You know, we're going to come out of this stronger and better than ever. with people who actually care about governing and with public servants that actually care about people.
Well, I'm going to leave it there, but I will say that is probably the most heartwarming answer I've gotten to that question in 15 episodes or so of recording these. So I am very happy for you, and I wish everybody in the world to have that much joy being who they are and doing what they do. We're going to take a quick break here, and we're going to circle back and wrap up with Random People, which is my favorite segment of the podcast, and then we'll send you on your merry way back to your regular life. Sound good?
Who the fuck are these people?
Shut up. This is my favorite part of the podcast.
Internet, are you ready? It's time for Random People.
All right, we're back, and it is time to play Random People, my favorite and America's favorite podcast segment. The way Random People works is I have a list of a whole bunch of random people. Some are occupations, some are religions, some are identities, some are genders, some are proper nouns and celebrities and just cool people from the world. So this list of 100 people, my guest here, Russ, is going to pick three numbers, 1 through 100. I am going to tell him the people who correlate with those numbers, and he's going to tell me the first three things that he thinks about those people. Now, the trick to all this is that I do get one follow-up question on each of those types of people. So if he says anything ridiculous, I get to pin him down on it. If he says anything interesting, you will get a story out of it. And then we will send our lovely guest on his merry way back to his regular life. So without much further ado, Russ, what are your three numbers?
Let's go with 8, 24,
and 68. 68. Are you a Kobe fan by chance?
What?
You a Kobe Bryant fan by chance? You went 8 and 24 off the top there.
Oh, wow. Wow. No. Yeah, I like Kobe. He was a good basketball player, right? One of the best.
Well, no, I just took both of his numbers right off top. I wasn't sure. All right. Where is 68? There we go. You got some good ones. All right. So I'm going to put 30 seconds on the clock. I promise you this is a mostly made up 30 seconds, but I will add a buzzer here if you take too long in post-production. So I'm warning you for that now. Do you want to start at number 8 or do you want to start at 68?
You said 68 was the most interesting, so let's go.
All right, 68 it is. So 30 seconds on the clock. Tell me your first three thoughts about drug dealers.
Wow. crime.
Okay.
Guns.
Okay.
Victims.
Okay. Way to turn that back into the DSA approved answer at the end. I appreciate you. all right. We'll move up to 24. Put 30 seconds back on the clock here. Give me your first three thoughts about Northern people. Obviously, you are from the North, so maybe this should be a telling idea of what we think about ourselves here.
Oh, it's like Northern Americans?
Or Northern, however you take it, is an open interpretation. I think I originally wrote it in thought of Northern Americans, yes, but I might be wrong.
Oh, okay. Oh, North Americans. Oh, okay.
North Americans, Northern half American, above the Mason-Dixon line, New Englanders. That's what I mean. Northern can go a lot of directions. My girlfriend's from Minnesota. I hadn't, like, considered that version of Northern before I met her.
okay. Colleges. Civil War. And... Oh, boy. first settlers.
First settlers. Okay. That'll work. All right. And the last one should be right in your wheelhouse, especially as, like, the party of working people. 30 more seconds back on the clock here. Give me your first three thoughts on blue collar people.
Profit creators. Okay. Unions. America.
Okay. All right. So, like I mentioned at the top, I do get one follow-up question on each of these, but only one. So I have to try and be careful with my words here, and I'm not that great at that on the fly, so bear with me. I want to start at drug dealers. So the first three things that popped in your head were crime, guns, and victims. I guess, how did those three things, like, relate in your mind? Like, who's committing the crime, who's got the guns, and who are the victims?
So obviously, drug dealers are committing crimes.
For now. we're legalizing it, baby. Like, we're figuring this out.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, you didn't specify what drug, so.
Fair. I guess in my personal experience, the only drug dealers that really know are people who sell pot, so.
Okay, yeah.
I guess you're right. Drug dealers writ large sell lots of other things, many of which are very criminal.
I imagine they have guns. And I
also not true of pot dealers. They have, like, beaded curtains and lava lamps.
Yeah, there's a lot of victims of the people who buy from them. Obviously, drug users are, we have the opioid epidemic in this country, and, you know, a lot of times, you know, laced with deadly drugs like fentanyl. Mm. And they're victims of that situation.
See, I, at first I thought you were going the opposite way, and we're like people who are victimized by other circumstances end up becoming drug dealers. But obviously, it kind of goes both ways. So I'm glad I followed up on that part.
I guess that makes sense. But I'm really, you know, concerned for the victims of the drug dealers, like selling bad drugs.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Moving on up, I guess, to the north here, colleges, Civil War, and first settlers. So like I said, I'm from Boston, I'm from Massachusetts. I'm just going to disregard the first settler thing because I'm so over that section of my American history, because that is all they teach you, like, age 8 to 16 here.
Yeah.
I guess being from not that far away, like just down the road in Staten Island in Jersey, like, do you feel like we have, like, an odd percent of colleges kind of consolidated here to the northern states? Because I've always felt like that being from Massachusetts, but I didn't know if that's specifically a Mass thing or if that's the whole north. And that was the first thing out of your mouth, was the colleges.
Well, for instance, my district, the 6th Congressional District, has 4 colleges in it.
No kidding, really?
And, wow. Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, Monmouth, Rutgers, and Middlesex, and... The fourth one, excuse me. But, yeah, I think we have more colleges up here. I'm not really sure if that's true or not, but that's what comes to mind. You know, we have so many colleges in New Jersey.
Fair enough. And then the last one, which I feel like is a good note to end on, as my last Democratic candidate for Congress interview here, was on blue-collar workers. And the first thing you mentioned was that they are the profit creators. I guess I wanted to give you a chance before we wrap up here just to kind of expand on that idea for everybody listening at home, because though I agree with you, obviously the workers make the product and the product makes the profit. I don't think a lot of people necessarily look at blue collar work as, you know, the people generating all of the profit for our society. So what exactly did you mean by that?
There are no profits without the hardworking blue-collar Americans that do the work, right? We are all the profit creators, the blue-collar people, and a lot of times it's not spoken of in that terms. Like, a lot of people identify the business as the profit creator or the job creator. That's what I hear a lot from the right wing. But the reality is, without the people doing the work, no corporation would make any profit. And I think that blue-collar workers need a fairer deal in this economy. Like I said before, we're dedicating our lives to working for these corporations, and then they just turn their backs with sharing the profits with their blue-collar workers. I think it's something that's not spoken about enough in this country, because almost all of us, 99% of us, are working really, really hard, and we create the profits in this country. And it's, we're all in this together at the end of the day, the blue collar, the white collar, the CEOs, the executives. But it's really important to know and respect the amount of blood, sweat, and tears that blue collar workers put into this economy as well.
I could not agree more. I found myself as a product of a blue collar family who is probably decidedly not blue collar in my own work or professions, and kind of forever indebted to not only the blue collar work that other people do, but the blue collar favors that people are willing to like provide for me, and like the advice that blue collar people are able to give to my life about very, you know, kind of monumental and quote unquote white collar decisions, right? Like you can't buy a house without some blue collar input on like how that house is built and how your plumbing is functioning and whether or not you should buy that house. You know what I mean? Like you can't make it, you can't make any of these like supposedly like highbrow decisions without any blue collar people informing them, or at least like you'll make the wrong ones if you are. And I think that's something that often kind of gets lost in translation. I guess the last thing I wanted to ask you, obviously this is the whole show here is about people and about various types of people and identity. You have a very unique and interesting story. I guess, who are the types of people you're kind of hoping hears this podcast, like hears this episode?
I hope everybody.
that is definitely the most common answer. I promise you that.
Oh, really? Okay. I hope more progressives hear it. I hope more undecideds hear it. And especially people in our district in New Jersey.
That always helps.
Yeah, it's been a great experience. I don't talk about my childhood or my early life that much. So, thank you for caring about that.
Yeah, man, that's what we do here. We care about people. That's the whole beat here. So I will say, progressive people, blue collar people, New Jersey people, people who are just interested in childhoods, drug dealing people, normal people, white collar people, northern people, whatever kind of person you are, I know you're out there listening because everybody listens to the Those People's podcast, or at least they do in my mind. Please be sure to check out Russ Cerencione, or it's Cerencione? Sorry, Cerencione.
Yeah.
Okay. It, yeah. All right. No, sorry. I'm getting better at the pronunciation game. I promise you at home. Be sure to check out Russ Cerencione. Russ, where can they find you on the internet? If people are looking for you for the campaign to learn more about you, to kind of follow up on what they heard here, and they're like, hey, that Russ guy was great. I want to do more with him. Where do they find you?
Yeah. So our campaign website is really easy. It's russforus2020.com.
Boy, that's a good sign.
And I love it. It rhymes. It's true. This campaign is about all of us, not me, us. Mm. And that's also all of our Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram handles. Russ for us 2020. And the 4 is spelled out. It's not a number. But the 2020 is a number.
Thank you for clarifying that, because that screws with a lot of people. All right. So Russ, FORUS 2020.
Yeah.
Perfect. Russ for Us 2020. Go check him out. You can find me, as always, anywhere on the internet. I want to be found at Mitch Gaines. Again, that's Gaines with a Y because I'm a little bit gay. G-A-Y-N-S. Thanks again for doing this, Russ. Thanks again to all of you out there listening at home and supporting the show. Till next time, I am Mitch Gaines. This is Russ Cerencione, and we are all those people.
So bad, you could just put it back. Don't have to be mean, don't have to be mad.
few quick housekeeping notes here after the episode. If you enjoyed the episode, please, please, please rate and review the show wherever you listen. It really helps other people find the show, and that's sort of essential to us being able to do a second season. If you really love the episode, or you just want to support the show, you can also buy one of our Political People t-shirts or some of our other merch available on our merch page at mitchgaines.com. If you have feedback for the show, I'm all ears. My Twitter DMs are always open, but you can also email me at mitchgaines@gmail.com. Prefer speaking to writing? Me too, that's why I started a podcast. You can leave us a voice message if you prefer at the link in the show notes here. Just note that your feedback, questions, and opinions may be used in a future episode. I want to give a special thanks to East Boston Public Library for allowing us to record several of our episodes on location there. Make sure you thank and hug your local librarian. Special thanks also to Phil Elam of the Justice Boys and Amy Bezunartea, hopefully I got that right, for our intro and our outro music, respectively. Both songs are fittingly titled Those People, and we'll post links in the show notes as to where you can find them. Lastly, and most especially perhaps, I want to give a special thank you to our executive producer, Kayla Scheitlin, without whom, and I mean this quite literally, none of this would be possible. I also want to give a final thanks to all those people who have been supporting this project from its earliest days, way before we released, including Irvin Bailey, Crystal Roloff, Nicole Hodnett, Shobo the God, and countless others that I'm missing here. I'm Mitch Gaines, and thank you as always for checking out this episode of Those People, a podcast with people about people.